Welcome to the Industrialise podcast, where we speak to those leading the charge towards the future of construction. This week, Darren Richards, Director of Cogent Consulting, speaks to Dale Sinclair, Director and Head of Digital Innovation at WSP. In this conversation, Dale talks about the challenges around establishing a good supply chain, how to take away complexity from projects, and some of the misnomers surrounding industrialised construction.
Welcome to the Industrialised podcast, where today I'm joined by Dale Sinclair from WSP. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you very much. Great to be here today.
Can you just tell us a bit about yourself, Dale, and your work at WSP?
Yeah, sure. My role at WSP, I've got in the UK, I'm a head of digital innovation, but just recently I've been asked to front up MMC for the company globally, which is fantastic because it allows us to build on the work that we're already doing in countries across the world.
And where's that taking you so far? What have you seen?
I suppose, it's a great question because I think across the world we're seeing different things. I think the UK is definitely the cutting edge of MMC, I would say. The Middle East is a great place to be, although it's obviously got different goals, but I think we will see some good insights coming out of the Middle East that we should grasp. And of course, Singapore and Hong Kong are quite good places to be, and we're seeing a lot of activity in Australia and some in Canada as well. So a bit mixed, but certainly I think the ball is now rolling, and hopefully we can keep it rolling and move away from construction into making more of our buildings and factories.
Well, I certainly think the opportunity for knowledge sharing globally is there. Just about joining up the dots, isn't it, and having the right people on the ground to facilitate that discussion and share the information. You know, we've hosted some international summits around offsite, and it's been quite interesting to compare how different territories around the world are adopting either similar practices or even different practices. You know, and one of the themes at the Industrialised Construction Conference in July, which you're speaking at, is actually around international best practice. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether we genuinely are as good as we think we are in terms of a global benchmark around industrialised construction. So one of your challenges, I guess, will be how you control that knowledge and share it within WSP. So are you having to introduce more systems within the business to share knowledge globally?
I don't think so, because we've got a really tight group that are interested in MMC, which means that we're not trying to scale immediately to our 70,000 plus people. It's quite a tight cohort. And I think the initial challenges are around terminology. So obviously in the UK we use MMC, we've got our seven categories of MMC. I think they are great in some senses. I think they are a little bit clunky, but they're good to put some definitions to, and I think we do need to decide, are we going to keep them? Our view is certainly we try and reinforce those seven categories globally because they do work quite well. But I think the term industrialised construction does seem to resonate more for some people. As you know, we've been using the term kits of parts recently. The reason for that was that I was speaking at the conference last year, and I used the term, and it resonated so well with people. So we thought, well, let's just keep using that. And we've just been building on that whole kit of parts process. I think the biggest term that is a challenge globally is the term modular, because it means so many different things to people. So some people it means volumetric, category one. Other people it means just doing things in a standardised way. So there is a challenge about some of the terms, but I don't think there's that much complexity. I think the biggest challenges around design for manufacturing assembly, some people, I believe, see that as really just optimising what we currently do. But for me, it's a completely different way of designing. And it doesn't, you know, what it says on the tin, so to speak, is you know, it's designing for manufacturing and then assembling a building. Today, we design for construction and we subset elements. It's not the same thing, and I'm sure we'll come on to that in the course of the discussion.
We definitely will, and you know, obviously some of it, there's terminology, there's technology, and then there's the culture as well, isn't there, around how to use these tools and these technologies and these techniques, I suppose. Have you noticed in your travels different cultural approaches. I mean, Singapore fairly famously has got, you know, a government-backed industrialized strategy and is driven from the center of government. So culturally, they have a certain way of approaching it. Have you noticed big differences when you've been to Oz or to North America versus the UK in terms of their ambitions or their drive or speed of activity?
Absolutely. Well, I would say the biggest trend is towards more volumetric. So certainly Hong Kong and Singapore, everything's predicated on volumetric. We think that's not the long-term approach. We're much more interested in panelized solutions. Now, whether that's panelized sub-assemblies within category one, you know, volumetric, I'm not sure. But certainly that's one trend that we see, that this perception that offsite is about volumetric, and quite clearly is not. That's just one solution that we might use to deliver a project. And the second trend is around materials. So in the Middle East, there is still a presumption in favour of concrete, which, as you know, is quite difficult to do volumetric boxes. And it's quite hard to do, for example, a home using concrete and panelise it and actually turn it into something that can be put together very rapidly. So really the material side of things, I would say, is where the greatest variations are. And of course, in the UK, we've got issues with timber because of the obviously all of the things that tumble out of the Building Safety Act. Mm.
Yeah, so I guess territorially, there'll be favourites, you know, favourite materials, favourite methods. But ultimately, it's about using the off-site manufacturing toolkit, isn't it? The broad spectrum of componentry elements, modules, whatever that may be. But to enable that, you've got to have good design management, good digital tools, good integration of all that information. So in terms of the role that you do, I would imagine a lot of your work is looking at the digital tools rather than the physical tools to enable the process.
So I would say my main observation today, especially as we all start to look at AI, is that without a doubt AI is going to be transformative in five years time. But today we need to get our we need all the new offsite content first, because if we don't have the content, there's really nothing for that AI solution to lean in on. So my own view in the short term, we should be really focused on creating the product of the future and creating the supply chains around that, because that's the biggest challenge. So when we create sub-assemblies, we do have challenges with some clients saying, well, where are we going to get someone to make this? So I think it's designing new things to allow rapid assembly on site, and then building the supply chains around these. Given that some of the components we are designing just now, there isn't an established supply chain.
No, and you know, this leads us kind of towards, I suppose, the narrative around platforms and, you know, integrating platforms and platform design and platform design for manufacturing assembly ultimately. And when you say the systems are not necessarily there now, I've read a lot in the press around a project you've recently done at Manchester Airport with Mace for the new pier. How did you find setting up or engaging the supply chain to deliver those fixed links the way you did? Was the supply chain willing to participate and wanting to give you their innovation, or have you had to drag the supply chain to that party?
On Manchester, and we've actually now worked with the same supply chain partners on a project at Heathrow Airport, so we have one process. I would say there was a bit of nervousness from them, so they weren't reluctant, but they were nervous about doing things differently, because for me, the essence of construction is we take thousands and thousands of small things to site and we put them together. So when we, I sometimes hear people saying, well, every building's a prototype, I don't agree with that, because the whole essence of construction is you take thousands of small things to site. That is it. That's the paradigm of construction. But in Manchester, we've got something like 67 sub-assemblies that come together on site in weeks rather than months. So a really radical reduction. But of course, to make that happen, we've had to figure out with Mace, who have been fantastic, how to take those components and put them together really fast. So we've got a Lego kit, another analogy, as you know, it gets used all the time. Our Lego kit is, each piece is 2 tons, so it's not like we can lift them with our fingers. And so figuring out how you take these large components, put them together, is really challenging. So we've had a very steep learning curve, but the subcontractors have been fantastic. And we've now adjusted our process, so we have crane drivers in the room very early on when we're doing kit parts now. We're not beholden to any specific solution on a project. And what we're finding is we're mashing together Category 1, Category 3, and Category 2 on the same project, because for me, you've got to have repetition and complexity to justify pushing things to the factory. And if you're shipping air, then obviously that's not an efficient use of off-site manufacturing. So very steep learning curve on our projects, but I think that from my perspective, the only way to make the transition to off-site is to get stuck in, create different components, figure out the supply chain, and then figure out all those elements. Coming back to your point on digital, so where we see digital really coming to the fore is, I don't think we can deliver the scale of infrastructure projects we have to do in the, across the globe using construction, nor one project at a time. So what we are counselling clients in just now is, can we move away from trying to do one project at a time? Let's do programs of work. Now, what would that mean? It would mean, let's say I'm a data center client, and we could figure out a way of having planning consent for 10 data centers, say in a city. Well, all of a sudden that client can then procure the content for 10 data centers. We can get economies of scale to kick in, and we really start to drive the value proposition around productivity. And that's what the main lesson for Mace, I think, has been on Manchester, is we need to drive much higher productivity benefits. And of course, the shift to the factory and assembly things on site is absolutely key to that change. And then once we have components in the first project, then we're looking at things that you've already mentioned, like catalogs, configurators, decision engines. But let's not forget, if I look at this in terms of some of the books I've published previously on design management, it's just about reusing decisions as important as anything else. So it's not necessarily just about creating the content. It's about actually reusing decisions and recording them properly. Because, as you know, in projects, people meet round tables just like this, and we make decisions. We're really bad at recording them, and we're certainly bad at making whatever we've decided to do available to, let's say, the next team that might pick up the same solution. So those are some of the cultural issues that we're finding that we need to address. But digital tools, key to programs, but the good old art of just designing things differently around D4MA processes is really what we're doing on our projects.
And you talk about the value proposition. It's not always cheaper necessarily to manufacture components in a factory and ship them. The logistics costs, the overheads of the manufacturing facility. But you need either a contractor or a client that's prepared to look at the bigger picture. Because if it was on pure capital and not on productivity, you probably would never build anything off-site. So how have you found, you said that Mace on that particular project, and I apologise to keep coming back to that, but just it's an example I've read a lot about. You said Mace were brilliant, I think, before on it.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're working with a very enlightened contractor there. One would imagine the Manchester Airport as a client is probably reasonably enlightened. They've developed a lot over the years. That is absolutely key, isn't it, for you to be able to deploy these tools. And if you don't work with the right contractor or the right client, it doesn't matter how good this toolkit of digital and physical product is, it's not going to get the best out of it, is it?
That's a really great point. It does need people to be really flexible. We do see people that, I call them the yeah butters, saying, the people that put objections in your way to doing things. We certainly are beginning to see the art of the possible. And a lot of the objections that we see, we've now got the evidence points that can remove those. Manchester has been a very difficult, steep learning curve, but I think we have actually, at the end of the day, we did make the right decisions earlier on about sub-assembly approach, and it has been really, the honing, I think, has more been about some of the detail, and let's say how do you put these really large components together very in a slick way once you get to site.
And did you do off-site field trials, prototyping, pre-production units for that, or were you literally learning on the first install?
There was some tests done, so there was obviously concern about lifting. Our sub-assemblies are 50 metres by 3 metres, so quite large. So there was concern that there would be deflection when we lifted them from horizontal to vertical, so we did do some testing. And we found the cladding panels that were obviously pre-installed in the factory. There was some racking happening, but it didn't impact on the cladding panels. So yes, we did do some tests beforehand.
And in terms of capturing the evidence to therefore manage future objections, you talked about productivity improvements.
Yeah.
How is that being captured? One would imagine that's being captured by Mace, and they're doing some comparisons between perhaps previously traditionally built peers or other products that are very similar. But how are they measuring productivity? Because I'm used to productivity measurement in a manufacturing environment. We have the tools and have done it for many, many years. In a construction site environment, it's much more difficult to do. So how is that happening?
I think there's two things that are challenges. The productivity improvements on site are a mixture of obviously doing things in the factory and then doing it faster on site. And I think the way, as you've already alluded to, of measuring productivity in factory is quite different to site. So I don't think there's a single solution to that, but it's certainly something that Mace are figuring out, you know, whether it's the amount of construction activity per hour. But I think ultimately it comes down to the amount of work that comes out the individual worker on the construction site. So how do you make that better, and how do we finally get the productivity improvements as the manufacturing sector has been leveraging for a long time?
It's an interesting challenge that, and at some point I'm sure somebody will do comparisons between manufacturing and construction, and we'll start to see the gap close with the more industrialized construction process that we use. I'm sure of that in the future. You mentioned before that you've got, I think you said, 70,000 globally within the WSP team, which is a large group by anyone's measure. Obviously, you're looking at the next generation of designers, engineers coming through. Does industrialised construction attract more people? Is it seen as being more sexy than traditional construction? It's got some edge to it that enables you to bring better talent to the industry rather than losing it to automotive or aerospace. Are you seeing that?
Taking a step back for a second, we certainly see that the process of designing buildings has become more complex, without doubt, as we look to decarbonize our buildings, whether that's embodied or operational carbon. And that is a challenge, I think, because we're trying to do more work for, in essence, the same fees fundamentally. And this is where the AI piece comes in and the program piece comes in, because we make thousands and thousands of decisions on a project. And if you've seen one of my lectures before, you know, I talk about the fact it takes 150 decisions just to design a staircase. But if you think about a staircase as a kit of parts, all of a sudden those decisions tumble down to a handful that need to be made with the client and also the contractor and the manufacturer. So for me, it's a decision-making piece that I'm really interested in, because I think if you can take decision-making at a program level, and we are doing that with the Environment Agency, we're doing a program of depots for them, and the whole goal there is how do we pool as many decisions as possible from the single project into the program. And I think that's where we begin to take away the complexity. And if we take away the complexity, the project teams can focus on the specific challenges of that project, and then the program team can be focused on things like materiality, researching new materials, looking at the best carbon approaches. So I think that balance of looking at things program and then look at things at the project makes our industry much more exciting, because then we've got more focus the program level elements facing up to government policy and some of the changes we might make there, but the project team laser focused on the specific issues of that project, rather than, as you know, if we were say doing 10 data centers, we'd probably be making the same decision every single time. Well, not the same decision, but there would be many decisions that we would be making every single time. And what we're trying to do is take some of that complexity away. So I think I'm really excited about the future of industry. I think a manufacturing-led industry driven by AI, things like decision engines and so on and so forth, would be a much more exciting profession for the next generation to come into. So yes, I'm really optimistic that we'll have a paradigm shift, and that will make our industry very exciting to lots of the next generation.
And it enables you to, I guess, multi-skill or diversify the existing resources you've got, use them differently, you know, encourage them to look at R&D as a process, you know, which, or new product introduction, you know, which manufacturing and again automotive would look at in a certain way. So again, you can re-energize and excite the people you've already got as well, can't you, with
exactly,
this process?
Exactly. But the challenge is we're learning so many new things. So we talk about real-time learning. We've got something like, I don't know, 14 Kittle Park projects on the go just now, or completed. And we're having to cycle knowledge like super fast from one project into the next. So it's not a case of having a kind of debrief feedback session at the end of a project. This is right. As we're learning things, we're instantly rolling that knowledge into new teams. But that's, I think, the challenge for our industry is predicated on heuristic ways of working and the knowledge in people's heads. Now, if that knowledge is not relevant anymore, that's the challenge. So in the 1990s, knowledge management was a really big topic, and it was one of these topics that somehow just frittered away and disappeared. But I think how we manage knowledge, to me, is of equal, if not greater, importance than trying to drive product into the factory.
Yes, and yeah, you know, extracting that tacit knowledge in the brains of all these great people you've got is a challenge in itself. And I guess there'll be tools, there'll be AI, there'll be apps, there'll be, you know, various things that maybe exist now, maybe they don't exist, and they will in the future, which will enable more of that knowledge sharing to happen, and that kind of live learning almost, because that's really what we need, isn't it, to move at a pace. Do you think then that linking that back to some of the perhaps challenging aspects of IP ownership and people's reluctance to share some of that knowledge, is that an issue that might hold this back? Because I still get a sense, certainly in the work that we do, that especially clients, you know, that are investing a lot of time, effort and money into your services, our services, for example, to come up with new ways of doing things. There's intellectual property in that. Not everyone is comfortable sharing that knowledge. Do you think we've got to break down some barriers around that?
We probably do, actually. But I'm not really... IP I've never seen as a challenge or barrier to what we do, because I think a lot of the things that we do are actually quite pragmatic and straightforward, so that it's quite hard to put an IP barrier around them. For me, it's those who get to the solutions first. So I've always been a huge fan of Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, and it's the case studies that are the most important thing to me, because the case studies give us the insights of what we've learned from a project. But more importantly, they allow us to demonstrate to clients that we're not just talking theory. We've actually got the hard knocks and the reality of actually doing offsite manufacturing. So to me, it's the case studies and learning that allow us to be maybe slightly ahead of some of our competitors, because that knowledge then allows us to. So it's that learning and case study components that are most important to me.
Yes, and the learning is not always good learning, is it? You know, it's the good, the bad, and the ugly, isn't it, at times? We don't get everything right first time, do we? You know, it's you know, it's important to kind of classify what that learning is and how to redeploy that learning and use it again. So I think the conclusion there then is that, you know, a lot of these process processes that are changing will attract new people who are up for the challenge. You know, the complexity of building, you know, end-to-end whole life designed for deconstruction now, you know, it brings some real complexities that requires people who are up for the challenge to the industry. It sounds to me as if it will help to attract more people. It'll perhaps make the industry a little bit more sexy, a bit more appealing. And perhaps the terminology of industrialized construction itself might intrigue and entice people in. Let's hope so.
I think that's the case, but going back to what you were saying about disassembly, I don't think we'll disassemble buildings in the future. I think we'll adapt them. And that's a key part of what we're looking at when we're considering a kit of parts approach, that we're really locked into circular economy processes, and that we're thinking about, well, how might this building be adapted in the future? And of course, that's a great thing that we're not just ticking the boxes of how we make things, we're also thinking about how those things work efficiently during the life cycle, and then that they can be efficiently adapted over their life.
And in terms of influence over those types of policies and strategies, obviously government's got a big part to play. I mean, I guess you've got a mix of government and public sector clients and private sector clients. And I think we're in a bit of a watershed moment when it comes to where government's going to go. We've got the new NISTA set up now, and we're due to hear, I think, an announcement on spending review in June, followed fairly closely by the 10-year infrastructure strategy. Do you engage with government much in terms of a consultative process to try and influence their thinking? Because it seems to me they're the real ones that have the pipelines big enough to make this happen.
Yes, we're part of the National Hospital Programme. Personally, I still chair the CIC Digital Forum, and we're looking at some really good initiatives there, mainly around AI just now, because we think it will be long-term, very disruptive technology. I chair the CB-1 group at BSI, and we're looking at elements there with them about how we get the standards for the future, because one of the challenges that we have as we look at new topics is how do we put some, let's say, standardisation wrappers around these new things that we're doing, which is great, which is why it's great that 8700 has come out on MMC.
Yeah.
And But I suppose, let's think, I mean, more specifically, a story I tell, and it is based in insights from work that we're doing for clients that are in various places across the world, is if you take London, London's got something like £35 billion of construction a year. So if you take 20% of that, that's £7 billion. Now, imagine the impact that would have on London if you could take that effort away from the site. There would be less disruption in local communities, because obviously we've got less workers, less white vans, less trucks. We would then be able to say, well, where do we want that activity to be? And maybe that's in micro factories spread across London that are networked. So we're beginning to get the productivity improvements by putting the factories close to the communities. We can drive social value propositions because we are building those factories next to the communities. Or we could even say, well, where are people available in the UK? Where is there high unemployment? So we could be in some of the areas in the Midlands or the north of England or north of Scotland even, where we're building factories to bring new types of employment. And that's something that really excites me, this idea that we can put the manufacturing where the workers are, and we can provide a much better experience for those that are making the buildings of the future. And how does that impact policy? Well, to get these factories up and running, as you know, the biggest problem with a lot of the volumetric housing companies has been predictability into the production line. And I think for me, it's the aggregation of project, so that program level approach that begins to bring some predictability, which investors would love to begin to build the factories of the future. And obviously that process of moving activity away from site into the factories.
And under the NISTA initiative or NISTA setup, I'm hearing actually tunes being played to that effect. I think there's a recognition in recent times that actually the aggregation of the demand to create these secure pipelines, which we know are always beholden to political change potentially, which I think is what makes people nervous. But there is definitely an understanding that if the key vertical markets of healthcare and education and infrastructure can be somewhat combined into a single pipeline, I don't think that will happen explicitly, but that will give the confidence to the industry to invest in the manufacturing facilities. But I think it's got to be a consistent message, and I think it's got to come from the senior levels. You know, so the industrial strategy, for example, has got to almost explicitly say this is how we're going to do it, and we are going to embrace industrialized construction processes to do it.
I agree, but I think the biggest challenge right now is we do not have the products. And let me give you two examples. So if we're going to build hospitals or schools faster, we need very different ways of doing internal walls, for example. We need smart wall systems that can be put up much faster than traditional drywall solutions, have MEP, pre-packed holing for ducts and risers and so on, already pre-installed. So, and similarly, if you, I guarantee if anyone listening to this podcast is in a space just now where there's a ceiling, look up at that ceiling, and I'll guarantee you that ceiling has been constructed. It's maybe some metal tiles, probably a plasterboard border. That is construction. Now, the products that change from those construction techniques into productization of, say, internal walls and ceilings don't exist. So let's not, before we get too excited about aggregation, I think we need to get some working groups of designers and fabricators together to say, well, how do we do these things differently? How do we do ceilings as products? How do we do walls as products where we can radically reduce the all the pain points that we have on site? So I think there's a piece of work to be done, because we're not talking about aggregating the construction products we currently have. We're talking about creating a whole new generation of construction products, like panelized elements. And I guess another good example would be we're all used to doing unitized facade panels, but on the whole, these are not available as products. And I certainly don't know of any building merchant in the country that has a stock of cladding panels ready for pickup and use in a building. So you see my point. Where there's things like baths and taps, or even drywall sheet and sheets of plasterboard. We can go and purchase these today, but what we want to be able to do is to do that with a whole new array of products, from panelized facades that are structural, ceiling components. And I think that piece of the jigsaw for me is fundamentally missing from all of the things I see. I see some amazing reports about how we're going to industrialise construction, but we have to get a whole new generation of products and the supply chain to make these products. And of course, supply chain resilience through competitive tension and having a number of companies that can do it. So that's where I think the effort is. To me, I don't see that piece of the jigsaw and a lot of the things that I'm...
And you're talking about a shift really from a component-based industry to an element-based industry, aren't you, where you're pulling together
exactly.
More components.
I mean, the car industry, as you know, I mean, things like headlamp assemblies used to be 20 components, and someone said, well, let's put those into a sub-assembly, and the dashboard now comes as a sub-assembly. It's that approach, it's aggregation of the pieces into larger components, because the simple premise is... the less components you take to site, the faster you can build the building. It's as simple as that. And the bigger those components are, the less smaller elements you're replacing with bigger elements. So that's where the effort needs to be, from my perspective.
I think you make a valid point. I think there'd be others in the industry that I would talk to that would say, well, give me the pipeline and I'll develop you the product. You know, the manufacturers that are sitting there will say, well, we're not going to speculatively invest hundreds of thousands, millions even, in a product unless I know you're going to buy it off me. So we got a bit of a chicken and egg. It's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it?
I couldn't agree more. There are a lot of chicken and eggs. And just now, some of the clients we speak to are waiting for the contractors to do this aggregation and create the content. other kind of contractors are saying they're waiting for the clients to do it. I don't see a lot of designers really trying to drive those. I see a lot of discussion about pattern books, or pattern books to me are really about standardization of rooms and spaces perhaps, but less so around a new generation of larger products. But I think that's why we all need to come together. Something, let's say it's something simple like a ceiling. Well, what would a ceiling look like in the future? How do we make ceilings as products that are really large that we can put up? And we're seeing some commercial clients in London already looking at, well, if we remove the ceiling in an office building, which is great because we save money, we save time, and we save carbon, but the MEP systems that we've traditionally used are designed to be hidden behind the ceiling. And so again, we're beginning to see maturity there. Some clients are saying, well, hold on a minute, if we're going to delete the ceiling elements, we need to design the products that are above the ceiling to look better. So it's those knock-on impact. But I think if we could get some commonality, I think we will see some of these new products coming, and then aggregation is inevitable, and then of course we get economies of scale kicking in.
And it may well be, you know, there's a role for some of the trade bodies here, you know, and Construction Products Association to, you know, act as enablers to get more collaborative R&D, you know, maybe have some shared IP, maybe have several companies that can produce the same components. Again, there's an automotive model, and I think people get sick of automotive being the benchmark, but they do some things very, very smartly. And, you know, we mustn't just go, oh, yes, but that's, they make cars, we make buildings, you know. There are a lot of the cultural elements and process elements, particularly around joint R&D, you know, and commonality of components that automotive has done very well and reduced their cost base and improved their quality, you know, exponentially over the last 20, 30, 40 years, you know.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
Okay, that's good. So let's just get on to one final point around kind of the myths surrounding industrialised construction, because we can shout from the rooftops, you know, and I hope we get a huge audience to the Industrialised Construction Conference in July, because we need to kind of start converting people, I think. But what would you like to kind of debunk around it? Because you've alluded to a couple of things that you perhaps disagree with, or you have a different view on. But what are we overhyping, or what do you think we should maybe pull back from in terms of debunking some of the myths around industrialised construction?
The biggest one for me is probably, I get people saying all the time, I've been doing it, Dale. We've done this. We did this 20 years ago. So I think this comes back to, yes, we've been doing some amazing offsite manufacturing for sure. As any PMV calculation will show, we already have a high degree of pre-manufactured value for everything from roof trusses to kitchens or whatever it might be. But I think all of those elements play into construction. They're a subset of construction. The building is designed fundamentally for construction. It pushes small quantities to factories, and that's where the inefficiency is. So I think that's what we need to tackle, is people have done some great stuff in the past, but it is all geared to construction. And if you come back to my point, designing for manufacturing and assembly is a manufacturer first strategy, and there are very few people that have designed a building to be manufactured and looked at saying, how do we subset construction? Now, don't get me wrong, because in some of our jobs we're doing concurrency of activity, because in situ foundations, for example, are a good thing for speed, because as we're making things in the factory, we're doing activity on site. But we're also finding that some clients maybe want the shortest touch point in the communities where they're building, and that would suggest, you know, buildings that are made more off-site. So there's a lot of things to unpack in there, but the main thing for me is, yes, we have been manufacturing elements of a building over the last 20, 30, or even more, if we go right back to Crystal Palace, you know, what's that, nearly 200
years
ago.
Yeah,
exactly. But we're not building buildings in weeks, we're building them in months, and we're not designing them in weeks, we're designing them in months. So I think for me, and it's like if I take my crystal ball and think about the future, we said to a client recently, said, we're doing 20 projects with you. How amazing would it be if by the time, maybe not number 20, but once we're well into that rollout of projects, how cool would it be if we were designing a building this week and we were on site next week? Now, if you unpack that, what does that actually mean? It means that you actually have to have content ready. So back to my point, you'd have to go and pick up the facade panel. So you're actually in that program, you're actually making things almost continually and then calling them off so that you can then get them on site. And then, of course, you say, well, hold on a minute, the planning process doesn't allow us to get onto site next week. So we need to look at program level planning processes. And I did mention, I did a keynote for the RTPI in Ireland a few weeks ago, and I said, well, how amazing would it be if one client with 50 buildings came into your country and you could say, we're actually going to give you program level planning consent? And this came up in discussion last night. I was out with some clients, and of course the question was, but how would you get around the NIMBYism in that localization? Well, then you say, well, look, it's, we need to think about the solutions, not the problems. And maybe the solution is we have more free zones where, you know, there are less planning consents, where there are, you know, there would be less concern about buildings being built. But you see what I'm saying? We actually have to think what we could look like in 20 years' time and then try to unlock the challenges. But I've always been a fan that you it's really hard to get to the future by just optimizing one piece at a time. I feel that we are optimizing construction today rather than thinking about how do we mobilize industrialized construction. And I think the best way to do that is to set a compelling vision for how things would work in the future, and then say, okay, now we know how it will look like in the future, what are the steps that we can now make as an industry to move and work towards that? And of course, it's not simple, because we've been constructing buildings for thousands of years. Our whole ecosystem, from building merchants to international conglomerates that make things, is all set around construction. So yes, there's a much harder piece that we need to do. But like I say, we can't do that one project at a time. We need to look at thinking bigger, thinking about programs, and just making the individual project much, much easier to do.
Agree. And I think, you know, that will then, you know, leading clients will then lead other clients into that process, and, you know, breed a bit of confidence, I think. You know, if you can map out the vision, you know, the milestones and the steps along the way that we need to go. I mean, it's an interesting challenge, because come back to the conference in July, day one is actually around strategy and possibilities, the art of the possible, if you like, with industrialized construction. You know, day two is very much focused on case studies and what's being delivered today. I'm hoping that we'll come away from that event, you know, having influenced circa 500 people, key decision makers in the industry, and inspired them to go away and do some of the things we've been talking about now. You know, so, you know, it's an exciting, possibly a watershed moment. Who knows? You know, we may just be preaching to the converted and all pat each other on the back. I hope not. I think we're aiming to convert people, you know, and go away from there with confidence that actually the industry can deliver something different. Yeah. So what would your key message be at that point, at that conference? What do you want to convey? If you said to the clients in the room, do X, what would X be?
X would be to try and come together and look at how they can aggregate these construction projects. Because if you take 10 clients and we're doing 10 projects, that's the construction components for 100 projects. If we can then get those into the factory, get agnostic supply chain so that we can really start to scale things, that's to me is part of the future. And going back to your debunking, I've just realized there's another thing we need to debunk, and that's that the shift to the factory means that we end up with cookie cutter buildings. I suppose that's something that's been chewing in my mind, because that's one of the questions I get all the time when I'm doing things like this. And my answer to that now is pretty straightforward and very emphatic. Good design actually works around constraints, and making things in a factory just becomes a constraint. And if Apple can design amazing phones that get made in the factory, I don't see why we can't design amazing buildings that get made in factories and provide configurators and other tools that allow us to actually design buildings that still look amazing. And if you take a typical building, I mean, we're in central London just now. If you go around London after this podcast, look around a building. You know, there's a brick opening, there's a window in it, it has a sill and a lintel, and there's probably half a dozen variants of that. And it's like music. We create thousands of tunes every day from the same notes, and it's the same. Think about traditional architecture. It's the same pieces, a half brick, a flush brick, you know, brick and a half. So that a typical window has got many ways. There are so many different ways they can put together. And I think it's the same with offsite manufacturing. I think we can come up with enough variation to just do things differently. So the things that you don't see get optimized and standardized, but the things that you can see can be configurable. So I am very optimistic that we'll see some amazing architecture in the future, and we'll decarbonize and improve productivity and shift things into the factory.
Let's hope so. Dale, it's been an absolute pleasure spending some time with you and listening to your views and opinions and your insight and your view of the future, if you like, in terms of industrialized construction. So thanks for participating in the podcast.
You're welcome. I've really enjoyed the conversation. So thanks for the invite.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Industrialized Podcast. This podcast was produced by Radar Media. The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Radar Media. If you enjoyed any of the themes discussed, then the Industrialized Construction Conference is the perfect place to hear more from the experts who are dedicated to the advancement of the construction industry. For more information, head to www.industrializedconstruction.co.uk.